So we're continuing our series going through the book of Galatians. And but before we dive into the passage, have any of you ever felt really, really angry? I mean, that volcanic bubbling of rage within you. That sense that you just can't control yourself anymore because there is... Do you know that feeling? Just me watching the England football team. This came to my mind recently in the horrendous story of the Post Office Horizon scandal, which has been bubbling on. It's been bubbling on for over a decade now, and it's as many have said, it's taken a drama to make people aware, or to get enough public momentum for something to be done about it. And it's been interesting speaking to people over the past week or so about what it is about this particular scandal, and it is shocking and horrendous in all sorts of ways, that makes them so angry. And there's all sorts of layers to it and different things that have triggered different people in different ways. There's the general injustice of it. How can something so unjust happen in a country that's meant to be democratic and at least relatively fair for people to live in? How can there be such a huge miscarriage of justice on such a on this scale? And there's the personal stories, hearing of people whose lives have been ruined, some of whom have now died, not knowing that they were vindicated. How can that have been allowed to happen? There's the idea of an establishment cover-up that makes many people deeply angry and upset too. How can they get away with this? Why were people trying to hide this? Why couldn't it be brought into the open and dealt with years ago? Who's in on this? There's also the sense of it, as one person put it to me, that here's another example of those with power not caring about the little guys and thinking they can walk all over us, to use their exact expression. They could get away with it because the postmasters didn't have any power, they didn't have a voice, they didn't have anyone who believed their story. There's also the disquieting truth that people put more trust in systems and in technology, which wasn't proven, than they did in individuals and their own story. There is much here that should and could make us angry, and anger is not an emotion that's alien to the story, the big sweep of Scripture. Scripture knows all kinds of anger. It's full of stories of people who behave badly because they couldn't control anger that they should have got a grip on. Anger can be a terrible thing. It can be used to oppress and to rage against and to abuse, and it can lead us to do terrible things which are out of our normal character and way of operating. But there's also in the Scriptures a kind of righteous anger, a godly anger that bubbles up within people throughout the biblical story, all the way through the prophets to individuals, through the New Testament, on into Revelation, a sense that there is injustice and unfairness in the world, and something should be done about it. That is an anger recognized in the pages of our Scriptures. So if you get angry at injustice and unfairness and hatred, then that is not an unbiblical feeling. What you then do with that anger, that's the bigger question, and one I'm not going to have time to go into today. But anger, righteous anger, is not a bad thing. And when we come to our passage today in Galatians, this is a book which is angry. It's cantankerous. It is Paul who writes this is not a happy bunny, to use a technical theological term. Last week we heard very quickly in the introduction, he does his standard kind of introducing himself. He says, "Grace and peace be with you." Now, normally after that, he'd go on to say all the things he loved about the church he was writing to. He'd write and say, "I love your use of Spotify. I love the way you utilize Zoom. I like the way that you all dress really well." He didn't say those things, but you know, he'd say nice things about the church. But here in the section, he'd normally begin by saying, "I give thanks to God for you." He says this: "I am astonished that you are so quickly deserting the one who called you by the grace of Christ and are turning to a different gospel." If you have a view of Paul in the Bible, by the way, that he's always angry and grumpy and raging, that's not how he comes across normally in his letters. We have someone with a pastoral heart who especially cares for the broken and the destitute and those on the margins. And I know lots of people will wrestle with Paul, but I think in the sweep of his story that we have in the scriptures, while we may struggle with aspects of what he says and how he says it, he is someone who clearly cares deeply and loves well and is loved by people in return. But to the church in Galatia, he is livid, fuming, cross, irate, cantankerous, argumentative. Something has happened here, which means he's thrown away all the normal conventions of how he'd begin a letter, and he begins instead with a place of rage. So what is going on? Well, it's all about this thing called the gospel, a word that's probably familiar to you in all sorts of contexts. This thing called the gospel, which for Paul here you can see is central to his understanding of what it means to be a follower of Jesus, has been somehow corrupted and diluted by what's been happening in the church of Galatia to the point that it is, as he says, really no gospel at all. A false gospel. It's not a gospel, the thing that they're doing. So what is it that has made Paul so angry? Well, I'm going to leave the details and the complicated bit of this particular debate down to those who are preaching over the next few weeks. So Hannah and Ian and Charlie are going to take you through the nuance here. So I'm not going to worry about that. Other than to say, this sounds strange to our ears, that it comes down to, among other things, circumcision. And I have to say, in all my years of ministry, I've never had to tell a church off for being really eager to go and get circumcised. That's not been an issue I've come across personally. But for Paul, this is a major issue for reasons that others will unpack to do with covenant and other things we'll be looking into. But for Paul, something has happened which has the risk to undermine everything that Jesus came to do. Something that could undermine the very community, this unique thing called the ecclesia, which is the Greek word for gathering, which we translate as church. This new kind of community that involves slave and free, male and female, Jew and Greek, this multi-ethnic community, this community that's for men and women, for those who are slave and free. Something has happened in Galatia which Paul sees has the risk to schism and destroy this beautiful thing that God is forming. Here's a quick pop quiz for you, well, a classics quiz. If I were to say to you, the die is cast, can you quote who's known for saying it? Go on, Murray.
Julius Caesar.
Well done, Murray. Thank you. I hope someone would do it in Latin. But I would say that popular formulation of the Latin that you just said isn't what he original said, but that's how it's come to be handed down to us. But that's by the by, Murray. That's by the by. I'll let you off. But very impressive. Well done. So the die is cast is this phrase, and it's said by Caesar, quoted by Suetonius, as Caesar is on the banks of the Rubicon, and crossing the Rubicon is another phrase that's entered into our parlance to mean making a decision that you cannot turn back from. So the scene is set that there's Caesar with the legions who are gathered with him coming back towards Rome. And he's got a momentous decision. Either he can turn back from rebelling against the Roman Republic and going in to force his way, or he can cross the Rubicon, take his troops with him and take Rome, or try and take Rome by force. Once he crosses the river, the die is cast. He can't turn back. Something so momentous will have happened that the world won't be the same again. Other choices will be closed down. A decision has been made. You can't go back. You mustn't turn back. It would be game over if you did. He'd be hunted down by the rest of the Roman army, and that would be it. For Paul, the gospel has a similar impact, but not just on the Roman Empire, but on the whole cosmos. Something has happened which is so momentous in Jesus Christ that to turn back from it, to alter it, to distort it, to change it in any way, is just unthinkable. It's dangerous. It must not happen. So while Paul's anger in Galatians to us may seem out of place, I could understand it over the post office scandal. But why are you getting upset with the poor church in Galatia? For Paul, something at here is so fundamentally at stake, something to do with justice and mercy and goodness and life and truth and hope and eternity, that if this thing is distorted now, the consequences, not just for the church in Galatia, but for the message that's spreading around the world about Jesus, that is fundamentally dangerous. So he is angry. He is very angry indeed. But as we talk about crossing the Rubicon and new beginnings, rather than talking about the nuances of this debate as we begin this series on Galatians, I just want to speak about what Paul meant, what he might have meant by this word, gospel. Because if you ever stop to think about this word, gospel, it's used in all sorts of ways. Keen, enthusiastic Christians with shiny teeth sometimes say, "Hey, do you believe the gospel?" Sorry about the accent for AM. We may love gospel music. Or we may have a sense that gospel is something to do with the four letters written by Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. So what for you does this word gospel mean? Why don't you just turn to your neighbours? No wrong answers here at all. And I'm just very quickly say, if you had to sum up what this word gospel might mean, if you're on Zoom, have a think at home or chat to those around you. Have a think. What do you think this word gospel means? Why might it matter? No wrong answers, no silly answers. Say whatever you like. I'm not going to ask you to share, but yes. Gossip according to. I like that, Steve. Truth, there you go. I'm not going to ask you to feedback, don't worry. That's between you and your neighbour, what you said. But the word literally means, it comes from the Greek word euangelion, which is the Greek word for good news. Literally, that someone's told you good news, that England have won the rugby, something wonderful's happened. And this word is used, or the Hebraic equivalent is used by Isaiah when he has this picture of a city that's under siege and at war, and they look out from the battlements and they see a messenger running from the battlefield to bring them news. And as you can imagine the scene, that this city's been under siege and it's under devastation, and they see someone running and he's waving at them. And they're listening out saying, what's the messenger saying? Is he saying it's game over, that our army's been destroyed? Or is he going to bring us a sign of hope in the uncertainty and the darkness? And the messenger's running and shouting and waving his arm. And as he finally comes into earshot, they can make out the word. Euangelion. Good news. Gospel. Good news. We have not been defeated. There is still hope. Our army has won. There is good news. Gospel is a word that means good news. In fact, the best news. And it came to be used by Christians to talk specifically about the news about Jesus. But if we want to get our heads around very briefly what this good news, what this gospel is, we need to very quickly cover what the bad news is that means that we need the good news in the first place. Because to have the answer for something, you kind of need to know what the problem is. And that leads me back to where we begun this sermon, which is the scandal of the Post Office Horizon system. Because how can such a devastating miscarriage of justice happen when it's being overseen by human beings? And human beings who aren't pantomime villains, they're people who have families, and they're people who give their time to their local communities, and they're people who have jobs and homes and hobbies and interests. The people who did this thing aren't out and out two-dimensional villains. They're human beings just like you and I are. And the terrifying thing, I think, about this scandal, one of the many terrifying things, is to put myself in the shoes of some of those who may have been senior managers in the know of this horrible business, and to think, if I were in that position, if I knew what was going on, would I have the courage of my convictions to be a whistleblower? Or would, if everyone else was saying, let's just go along with this and push ahead, because, you know, it will all blow over, would I take a stand? I like to think I would. I'm sure you'd like to think you would too. But actually, so many people, so many of us, when push comes to shove, end up going along with the flow. Now, it's very easy to shout and rage and get angry with those who are in those situations who make these mistakes. I'm not saying we shouldn't be angry. I'm saying there's something deeply flawed within each one of us. That there's always a handful of people who seem to show extreme courage to do the right thing in horrible situations. And yet there is something distorted at the heart of human nature whereby we just have potential as human beings to muck things up. Have you ever noticed this? That even in our best things, all of us can distort and damage relationship. Has anyone here ever hurt someone that they loved just through a flippant comment or doing something or a bad decision? Has anyone here ever damaged a relationship with someone that it seems that you can't repair it? I know I have. Has anyone ever messed things up and hurt the environment around them, damaged nature through carelessness? Does anyone here drive a car? Does anyone here damage the environment in all sorts of ways? I'm not equating all these things. I'm saying there is something fundamental about us as human beings, that we have a problem that even at our best, we tend to become part of systems which cause oppression and suffering and hurt and misery. That even when we try hard, we tend to damage the world around us. There's something wrong at the heart of the cosmos. There's something which seems to be damaged in how we live to one another, that we can't get this quite right. And the Bible, and we're going to be exploring this in a more profound, detailed way during Lent. We're going to do a brilliant series looking at covenant. I think it's going to be brilliant. I mean, you could agree afterwards. It's going to be really good. And we're going to look at the big picture of what this looks like. So I'm not going to go into the details now. But the Bible tells a story of messy people doing messy things in a messy world. And yet in all that messiness, there are signs of hope, of love, of laughter, of goodness, of grace. And yet we can't sort things out for ourselves. And the tragedy at the heart of the biblical story is not only do we hurt one another, and not only do we cause injustice to the vulnerable, but we also cause a damage between our relationship with the God who made us, whose desire is for us to know that we're loved, to know that we're welcomed and accepted, who's created us for love and to know that we have a relationship with him, that we are eternally and radically and wonderfully loved. The good news is that God will not stop loving his people, that he won't give up on us, that he won't give up on you. No matter what you've done, no matter what a mess you've made of things, he will find a way to make a way to restore relationship. That's what the gospel's all about, the reconciliation of all things between people of different ethnicities and backgrounds, between families that have been broken by hurt, between our physical bodies, which can be damaged and grow old and be broken, and a promise of healing. And the promise of Jesus is that one day all will be made well, but also in the here and now, this thing called church can model a new kind of community where people build relationships with one another and with God, which transform the world around them. The good news is that our sin, the stuff that damages relationship between us and each other, between us and the planet, between us and God, has been forgiven because God himself died upon the cross, so that all the anger and frustration we feel about injustice we see, all the anger that we have about the injustice that we see in the world around us, is all the anger that others in the world may feel about us in the Western world for having our superior kind of lifestyle and the GDP and homes that we can afford to heat for food on our tables, all the anger against us is nailed to God upon a cross. He opens his arms wide and he says, I love you, I forgive you, and I will make all things right. I've not begun to scratch the surface of why this is good news. I've not done justice to it this morning. We'll unpack this over the coming weeks and we'll look at it more in Lent. But know this, that there is good news, that it's worth being passionate about, as Paul was, that you are forgiven if you want that forgiveness, that all relationships can be restored, that there's nothing that you can do, that you have done, that can separate you from the love of God, and that Christ Jesus came for you to walk on the earth. He died for you for the mistakes you've made, And because of that, somehow, through some work of God's grace, you are a new creation, a forgiven person who will always, always have hope. So be angry about injustice, but know that God is dealing with it in us, that there is good news, that he won't give up, that there is always hope, that because of Jesus, the Rubicon's been crossed, a new created order has been made. There is always good news. There is always hope. We'll explore that more in the coming weeks.